Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Saturday, March 3rd, 2012. I'm so glad I don't have to say February. This is episode 853. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use the promo code TECHGUY for a no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 free postage. Stamps.com. And by Gazelle, the easy way to sell or recycle your used electronic gadgets from your home or office. Don't just sell it. Gazelle it today at Gazelle.com. Good day to you. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk computers and the internet and cell phones and camcorders and MP3 players and home theater and all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number if you want to talk. Ask a question, make a suggestion, get some hand-holding on the information superhighway. We were, before the show began, we were listening to some Dr. Seuss. Yesterday was of course his birthday. I wonder how old he would have been. I'm sure there is somewhere. If only there were somewhere on the internet you could go and look stuff like that up and get all the information that you would want. 1904, March 2nd. So he would have been 108. Wow. We were listening a little bit to the musical they made of his life. Of course, absolutely. They've got a new movie of The Lorax. Haven't seen that, but I'm sure it's good. It's got to be a little challenging if you're making a movie of a Dr. Seuss movie, a Dr. Seuss book. But they just begged to be. And then when we were talking about, and I just love this, is the tradition at my kids' high school, when the seniors graduate, they have an all-night party. They lock them in and keep them away from drugs and booze and give them magicians and makeup artists and bands and have performances. You know, it's really fun. And at the end of it, after they've stayed up all night, it's 7 in the morning, their parents about to come pick them up, their favorite teacher, a guy named Brandon Spars, who's such a wonderful storyteller, he actually studied this, gets Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go. And starts reading it to him. And I just get teary thinking about it. And what it made me think of is there's a really great, I'm playing it right now on my iPad. You can probably hear it in the background. There's a really great iPad version of this that'll read it to you, let you read it yourself. It kind of comes to life, but it's the original illustrations, which is wonderful, and the original text as well. It really a great, the iPad is such a great vehicle for a book like this to bring it to life. Of course, you can read it with paper, and it's not that much different. It's a little more interactive. Of course, they have audio, so it'll read it aloud to you, which is great for little kids that can't read. There's a lot of great Dr. Seuss books on the iPad. And now, thanks to Apple's author program, there are some wonderful textbooks coming to the iPad as well. It's going to be a great textbook platform. I mention this because we are just a few days from a big Apple announcement. March 7th, Apple sent out the invitations. The press will gather as they have right about this time, 2 years in a row. It was January 2010, then March 2011, and again in March 2012, that Apple brought everybody together at the Herba Buena Center for the Arts to announce the next iPad. And the invitation itself has an iPad picture right in front of it, with a finger touching it. And, of course, the Kremlinologists and all the Apple rumor guides and everything have analyzed this picture. Gizmodo attempted to take a duplicate picture on an old iPad and compared it to the new and came to the conclusion this is definitely a high-res display. I don't know if you can be sure of that because, it's hard to tell in a photograph. And people were looking at it saying, there's no home button. Of course, if it's sideways, there wouldn't be a home button. There were all sorts of reading the tea leaves from this Apple invitation. But here's one. Here's a few things I think we can safely say. Yes, it will be the next iPad. What will they name it? Probably the iPad 3, but that we can't even be sure about. What will it contain? What will be different? That we're not sure about, but I think the consensus is it will be a high-resolution display. Twice the resolution horizontally and twice the resolution vertically, giving it four times the number of pixels. That means it's 2048 across by 1536 up and down. And if it's on the it's on the same size display, which I think it will be, as the existing iPad, kind of looks like that, at least in that invitation, it will be the best-looking display you've ever seen, if any of us have ever seen. It will be spectacular. Now, there are calculators out there. You can figure out how many... What matters in all of this is the number of dots per inch or pixels per inch on the display. And the reason Apple called the iPhone 4 display a retina or retinal display, they said because you couldn't, with plain unaided vision, see the pixels. They're so small, so... The resolution is so high, you can't even see the pixels. Now, of course, if you hold the iPhone 4 up to your eyes, you can. It's not. It has to be at almost arm's length to do that. But the pixels per inch is very, very high. And that's fantastic because it means it doesn't look like a display. You don't see the screen door effect you sometimes see in regular displays. You can't see the dots. It looks like a piece of paper. And the color's more vivid. Everything's more vivid. So I think this is a really good move if Apple is doing this. There is a calculator, a DPI calculator. If we say the horizontal resolution, I'm just going to run this right here. It's at members.ping.de. If you want to calculate along with me, if we say it's I'm pretty sure that this is what Apple will do. This is what they did with the iPhone. They doubled it. So that way, you don't have to redesign the software. You just scale it. And when pictures are doubled, they look better than if they're 1.3 bigger or 2.4 bigger. So it's pretty clear. We'll do 2048 by 1536. And what is it? Is it 9 inches? What is the size of the... I can't remember. 9.1 inches, something like that. We'll get a dot pitch of, as I remember, 253 pixels per inch. That's a lot of pixels per inch. It's 9.7. Thank you. Chat room knows all. Yeah, 263 pixels per inch. That's pretty nice. That's the iPad 2 is it half that or a quarter of that? It's a lot less. It is, it's 131 pixels per inch. It's not as high as the iPhone 4, which is 329 pixels per inch. So if you have an iPhone 4 or 4S and you look at that, it's something like what we'll see with an iPad 3, but not necessarily exactly. Close enough, though, that if you had an iPad 3 with that kind of resolution, it would be spectacular. Movies in 1080p high def, you'd be able to display them. Now, you're going to hear a lot of talk from Apple. Oh, in fact, I suspect what they'll announce, as well as the new iPad, is they'll announce, yes, and now 1080p video on iTunes to rent or buy, and the Apple TV, I expect they'll update that, probably new hardware to support 1080p, and they'll be making a big deal about how much better it is. It's funny because, I don't know if you remember this, but they were kind of saying, it's not better. And and the truth is, on a display this size, a 9.7-inch display, 720p, 1080p, you're not going to see that much difference. It's only on a bigger screen that you'd notice a difference. But they'll make Wednesday, they'll be talking about, and it now is full HD. That many pixels means you're going to have a faster computer, probably a faster processor, most important, a faster graphics unit. So I think it's likely that they will do... You know, the current processor in the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S is Apple's own design called the A5, based on an ARM Cortex. They will probably do, I think the rumors are, something called an A5X, not an A6. They won't do four cores. They'll do dual cores, faster graphics. So it'll be a much faster iPad. I hope a better camera. And I'll tell you about the price when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. What a tease.
You're going to make me cry, Kyle. That's not nice.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, the places you'll go. Happy birthday, Dr. Seuss. He was 100. He would have been 100. What did we say? 108 yesterday. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo's the number to call. So how much for all this new goodness will the iPad 3 be? Well, there's a rumor today. Images apparently from Apple. I don't know. Supposedly. They say the pricing will be the same. No change. That would be good news. And that's pretty much, that's to be expected. Generally, the way Apple works is they add power, not drop price. And if they can do it, if they can put that new display in and the new processor, and I suspect a better camera as well, they'll do it. When will it be available? Well, no one knows. When the Apple first announced the iPad, you remember in 2010, it was 3 months we had to wait. But that, and that makes sense because they didn't want anybody... This was a brand new product. They didn't want anybody to know about it while they went through the FCC approval process. So that was one thing. And of course, they can afford a 3 month delay when you announce a brand new product. There's no chance of it killing the existing product. But last year, remember, they didn't wait much time. Was it 10 days? And that was because, of course, iPad 1 sales stopped immediately as soon as they announced the iPad 2. You would expect the same thing. If they announce a hot new iPad 3, iPad 2 sales will be dead in the water, unless, and I think this will happen, they drop the price significantly. I suspect for those of you who've been wanting an iPad but didn't want to spend a minimum of $500, maybe we're eyeing the Kindle at $200, the good news will be that Apple, I'm pretty sure, will offer an iPad 2, the current model, soon to be the older model, for, I would guess, somewhere between $300 and $400. They don't have to drop it down to $200, but somewhere between $300 and $400. So a $350 iPad 2, a $500 iPad 3. Availability, well, I'd say about a week to 10 days, so maybe March 17th. But I did get an email from somebody who swore he worked for Apple, showed me some images that kind of inclined me to perhaps believe him. He said, no, it's going to be 3 days. It'll be available Saturday, March 9th. Mm. Or 10th, I guess that would be, wouldn't it? Saturday, March 10th or Friday, March 9th. Actually, I think he said the 9th. So, you know, if you're trying to sell an Apple iPad 2, you've got iPad 3 on the way. You don't want it to be too long because you know sales will drop off. You probably drop the prices immediately of the iPad 2, so you don't want to wait too long to get that iPad 3 in stores. We've been hearing rumors since November that Apple was cranking them out as fast as they could because they wanted to make sure there'd be plenty in stores. So I think I buy all of this. It all fits together. Remember, it's all rumors. Apple doesn't talk. But the rumor is, well, as I just said, all of those things, all of the above. An iPad 3, we certainly know the announcement date will be March 7th. Retina display, I expect 8 megapixel camera comparable to the iPhone 4S. A faster processor. Battery life, well, it's hard to say the battery life will be better because that new screen is going to take a lot more juice. So the rumor was thicker so that they could accommodate a larger battery so that they wouldn't lose battery life. So let's hope something like the 10 hours. That's plenty, isn't it? Don't you think? 10 hours battery life seems to get me through the day on an iPad. And available March 9th? Let's say 9th. That all sounds pretty good. That's what I'm putting my money on. If I were a betting man. We have more to talk about. Windows 8, the consumer preview is available for download now. We'll talk about first impressions of the new Windows 8, which will be out sometime later this summer. And a lot of new phones coming. The big Mobile World Congress happened this week. in Barcelona, and HTC, LG, and many others announced, of course, Samsung, some brand new phones. We'll talk about that too. 8888 Ask Leo. The website is techguylabs.com. Go there if you want notes on everything we're talking about. I'll put them up there. And there's also a link to the chat room, always fun. I watch the chat room like a hawk, looking for Apple employees to tell me what's going to happen and other things. You could join that chat room. There are about 800 or 900 people in there right now if you go to techguylabs.com. Let's get to the phones, though. Our first call of the day comes to us from Scottsville, Arizona. Scottsville or Scottsdale? It's Paul on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Leo. How's it going today?
It's going well.
I've got a strange one for you. Well, first of all, you guys are going to give me a bad time because the hardware we're going to talk about, it's a little old. It's a PowerMac G4. It's the one that's like a half a basketball model. I'm sure you know what I'm talking
about. You mean with the lamp arm off of it and the screen on top of that?
That's the one.
Yeah, that was the cute Mac. That was the Mac that I always thought Pixar based that it was based on that Pixar lamp, right? The Luxo.
Yeah, exactly.
Junior.
You're right.
Yeah. First of all, Paul, let me say right up front, I never mock anybody for old hardware. I admire your thriftiness. And in truth, these things should last forever, right? They don't wear out.
No. And little background, I've only used Macs since I started this publishing company. I used the very first Skinny Mac back in January of 84. And so in my company, I've just upgraded them over time. And this one was my desktop model at the office that I brought home, and I replaced it with a big boy.
Now, how's the arm on that? Because that was the one issue with that, was after a while, the arm got a little loose.
No, it's perfect.
It's perfect.
Absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, Johnny Ive spent a lot of attention to that arm, believe it or not. If you read the Steve Jobs biography, they thought a lot about designing that, Mac. So you have a classic. It's like a classic car. You have a classic iMac.
Yeah, along with the LC and the 6500 and everything else I have out in storage.
It isn't quite like cars, is it? A classic computer is not quite as desirable as a classic car. I'll admit that.
You know, my wife kind of sees it the same way, so I'll just leave it at that. but what happened was this one, for some reason, along the way, iPhoto just decided that it was no longer going to launch. And it'll bounce up and down and get ready to launch, and then it'll just crash upon launch, and I cannot figure out why or who or what happened to it.
You didn't upgrade it. You didn't upgrade it at any point, did you?
Only along with whatever the software upgrade was for the systems. So of course I'm up. I think it's 10.5.8, but it's been upgraded along the way.
But I think it's related to this because they've updated iLife several times.
Right.
Did you ever buy a new iLife, or are you still using the iLife that came with? I don't even know if they had it in 2001 when this thing, or 2002 when this thing came.
No, we have added an iLife to it, and I think in doing some of the sleuthing, it looks like it's an iPhoto 5.0.2.
Okay, good. That's
here's
helpful.
The crash report.
That's
here's the
so
crash
five.
Report
so it's iPhoto 5.
Yeah.
And let me see if I can find out what their requirements are.
I launched it again, and it gave me the configuration of all the stuff, which is where I found that out.
So you understand that Apple, at some point, took iPhoto, the iLife package, and said, we're only going to run on Intel.
Yeah,
and you, of course, don't have an Intel. You're using what version of the OS? 10.5, huh?
Yeah, 10.5.8. Yep.
So that's probably the last one that'll run on that machine.
It is.
Yeah, let me look. I suspect that that's the issue, but I'm going to check here. Hold on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Paul's in Scottsdale talking about his old classic iMac.
Ancient.
We've got Mike is in our studio audience today. He's a developer, but he said, there ought to be a business, like classic car business, for people to take classic computers. Keep them running. The truth is that computer would run just fine if you never tried to do anything modern on it. But
exactly.
But times have changed in 2002, and you want to do modern things on it. So Paul did suggest, or Mike did suggest, and I think this is true, it could be, let's hope it's something simple, not a incompatibility between your hardware and your OS and your software, But if it's something simple, you can, and this, you know, anytime there's a database, and in iPhoto, of course, there's a database of images, that can get corrupted, and then the program will sometimes crash, like it's crashing for you right now. I actually had to dig to an Apple support article, HT2042. This is back in the days when Apple's support articles only numbered in the thousands. They're now in the hundreds of thousands. And it said, if you have iPhoto 5, which you do, and you want to rebuild it, quit it, then hold down the Command and Option keys and open it. And at some point, continue to hold those, and at some point, iPhoto 5 will say, would you like to rebuild your library? Say yes.
Wow.
Well, don't wow until it works, but that's certainly something you might want to do. And, of course, on a Mac, anytime a program crashes, the first thing you do is you delete the library, you know, the application support files in the library folder, and those are all the preferences and things like that. If those get corrupted also, that can crash a program. It's crashing on launch, which means something it's loading when it first starts up is not making it happy.
And that was my fear, is that in upgrading the systems along the way, that something wasn't happy with iPhoto. And then it just got even crazier when I brought the machine back to the house, because the AirPort that I'm using here is the latest gen, and the one I have at the office is the previous gen. So the AirPort doesn't work here with this computer either. So
that's probably, do you use it? You know, AirPort Wi-Fi was Wi-Fi even in 2002, but the encryption systems changed, and probably that older computer doesn't support the new WPA2 encryption. Are you using that at home? You should be. It's safe.
Yeah.
So that's probably all it is. You'll have to go back to WEP.
Yep. Okay.
It's probably a hardware thing. In other words, not a software thing. But I don't know. But that would be my guess.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm a faithful listener every week. I love your show.
Thanks, Paul. I'm really glad you listen. And keep that beautiful. That was a work of art. And if you haven't read the Steve Jobs biography, there's a portion of the biography where they talk about designing that Luxolamp iMac. And the big concern was the arm. The arm, you know, it's got a half a basketball base, white, beautiful white, snow white base, with a arm, chrome arm, and then the screen on the arm. And, of course, the concern always was, well, you know how these arms get. After a few years, they get limp, and they can't keep the screen up, or it squeaks. And apparently, Johnny Ive put a lot of effort into it, and I'm glad to hear that on this 10-year-old iMac, it's still proud and high. That's wonderful. Jonathan, Portland, Oregon. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
Great. Wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I've been listening for 5 or 6 years, and this is the first time I've had a reason to call. So.
Good. That means your computer life has been happy, wholesome.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. Excellent.
So my question, I've been podcasting with some friends for about a year, and we want to start video podcasting. And what we have been doing, and we just started the last week or two posting on YouTube, and we want to find a good way to convert those into a feed that would work on iTunes without having to host the files ourselves.
Oh, what a good idea. YouTube doesn't create an iTunes-compatible RSS feed, I guess.
Right. And well, I Googled
why
it,
not?
I didn't see anything.
It sure should. That doesn't seem like such a big thing to ask. Huh. I would say that, I mean, certainly you could do it by hand. You know, you have a link. Well, actually, no, you can't. Wait a minute. What am I thinking? Don't! Here's the problem. You can't download a video from YouTube, can you?
Right. No.
They don't want you to do that. They want you to go to the page and watch that video and see all the ads.
So we'll probably have to post them ourselves if we want to feed it into iTunes.
Yeah. Yeah, because for a podcast to work, it is a download, right? People need to download the file so they could play it back on their device. It can't be just a link to a Flash video.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would go to Libsyn, LIBSYN.com. They're very affordable because your issue is going to be bandwidth. What if your show takes off?
Right.
And all of a sudden, you got to pay for the bandwidth. That's why you wanted Google to foot the bill. And that's why they don't foot the bill. So, I don't think there's any way to make an RSS feed of Flash video or YouTube video. I don't think there's any way to do it. Okay. So, what you need to do is go to Libsyn, upload the video to Libsyn. You'll be able to make it better quality that way anyway.
Okay, that's good.
Libsyn charges not for bandwidth, but for storage. And I wonder, in chat room, I'd love to ask you, is there anyone else, Vimeo or somebody, who would host those files in a way that you could use an RSS feed? I'll have to check it out. Let me see if I can find something. What's the name of your podcast, Jonathan?
We call it the Primetime Podcast, and our website, theprimetimepodcast.com, has our feed of the audio and the video stuff that we're starting to do. So the film and TV entertainment podcast.
Oh, it sounds great.
Thanks.
That's a hot area to be in right now.
Yeah. You know, we've got a couple people who work in local TV stations and a lot of people who are hobbyists, and there's about six of us that rotate in the show, and we just have a ton of fun talking about stuff we love. So, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Wow, this looks really great, actually. This looks like a really good show.
Thanks, man.
I'm going to start watching. I guess listening until I can watch.
I love that. Yeah, thanks.
You know, that's how we do it. We offer video of this show and all the shows that I do on my podcast network. But it's, you know, we store it on a site so you can download it. I don't think, you know, and of course, as everybody knows, you can get programs to download YouTube videos. But I don't know if there's any way to then tie it to an RSS feed that you could then publish on iTunes. I think that's a two-step process. Good luck, Jonathan. What a great idea for a show. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. Microsoft, this is a big week. We got the Apple. And I knew that Apple would do this, by the way. They sent out invitations the day before Microsoft announced its Windows 8 consumer preview and did a big event. I knew they would do this. In fact, I thought it'd be the same day. Maybe they were being generous. Oh, we'll do it the day before, give you a little bit of the news cycle. But of course, when Apple does something like this, even if it's just sent out an invitation, it just owns the news cycle. Just owns it. And that's all anybody talked about. But Windows 8 consumer preview is available if you go to windows.microsoft.com on any Windows compatible machine, including a Mac if you have VMware or you want to use Bootcamp. I believe it'll work with Bootcamp. You can download it and try it. And I did, and I'll tell you my reactions. Windows 8, here it comes. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, right after this. Kyle Benham's making fun of me because I've been complaining about entering the key in the Windows 8 consumer preview that Microsoft gives. Now, I'm sure there's technical reasons, but they are giving this software away. It works. You'll be able to use it till January of next year. And nevertheless, they require you to enter a key, a product key, as if, you know, this is some privacy or some piracy protection. And the key that they gave me didn't work. So the chat room gave me a better key. I don't know where it came from. I guess I shouldn't worry about it, right? What could possibly go wrong? We got Sean in here, also in our studio audience. We have an open studio. I'll invite people to come by and visit. We've got some great people, Sean and his dad, Robert, and Mike's in here, and Alan just joins us from Boston. But Sean is a podcaster, high school sophomore, does a show called Being the Difference. That's a video podcaster. He says Blip.TV will also do this for a nominal fee if you're HD and for free if you're not. They'll store the video and make an iTunes feed of it, which is great. So there you go. There's another solution for your Hollywood podcast. Blip, BLIP.TV. I guess they're paying the bandwidth. I'll never understand. I just don't get it. How does this company stay in business if they give away bandwidth? They don't even put ads. I guess they want you to, they don't require you to put ads in there, but maybe they're hoping you will, and that's how they make their money. Anyway, I know the folks at Blip.TV. They're great people, and that's a great solution. Blip.TV. And they will host it for you and let you make a video. By the way, it'll save your process, too, because Blip has an uploader that will upload to many sites, including YouTube, at the same time. So you upload one copy. They store, make an RSS feed for iTunes, and upload it to YouTube. So you're still going to have your YouTube videos there. So it sounds like a perfect solution. John is in Colorado Springs. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, John.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Hey, I'll get right to it. I like to listen to all your podcasts that you got on your Twit network, and I download them onto the computer and transfer them onto my Android phone that way. But I can't find a good music program to listen to them on. Specifically, I want one that'll bookmark the location when I stop listening to it, so it'll pick up the same place when I start again.
Yeah. You know, iTunes and the iPods do that because they will look at there's a setting that is an iTunes-specific setting that says this is a podcast or this is an audiobook, so don't start at the beginning. You know, with a song, you don't want to, if you listen to half a song, you stop, you go, you don't want to start in the middle. You want to start over again most of the time. So songs are treated that way. But you're right. You're listening to a, you know, 2-hour podcast. You don't want to start over or have to fast forward through it.
Right.
So we need an app that works on Android, kind of like the iPod does.
And I've tried Beyond Pod and Double Twist, and both those, they don't even recognize the podcast because they want you to download them through the app.
Oh, that's interesting. I bet you if you downloaded it through Double Twist, it would at least behave properly. I use Google Listen. Have you tried Listen, the free program Google puts out?
I tried it many moons ago, but I haven't tried it recently.
It has some flaws. It's a little quirky, but as I remember, it always picked up where I left off. Because Listen is assuming that this is a podcast, right? That's all it does is play podcasts.
And you were able to transfer from your computer to the phone and instead of downloading through the app?
Ah. That's a good question. Would it look in the right place? No. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Chat room saying there's a program called, it's a free German program called Audiobook Player 2 that will work. Again, you know, again, these things work because they assume that what they're looking at is not music. So this is like an audiobook player. Is it a free version, a paid version? It looks like you can. What you need is something that you can point to a directory and say, whatever's in this directory, that's what I want you to play. Because then you could put the books in there. Well, this is free. I would try this one.
Audiobook player 2.
Yeah. That's the chat room says that works. They also say Dog Catcher will import, and that's the key, right? You want to be able to import.
Yes.
If it's a podcast player, as Dog Catcher is, it should act appropriately. In other words, not start at the beginning every time you listen, but start at the now I'm in German. You've made my good. I clicked the link. The chat room gave me a link, and now my Google is German from now on. That's terrible. I gotta change that. Das Google. Denise in Santa Clara, Clarita, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Leo. Yeah, I had a question. I have a Mac Mini computer, and I have Snow Leopard, and I wanted to know what I need to do prepare to upgrade to Lion.
Yeah, because Mountain Lion's coming out.
Yeah, I know. I heard that Apple is eliminating some of the Intel Macs that you won't be able to.
How old is your Mini?
I got it in May of 2009. It's
You're good.
Intel Core 2 Dual.
Yeah. It's only computers 2008 and earlier, and it's the ones that use the Intel onboard GMA graphics of a certain vintage. You're okay if you got it in 2009, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Hallelujah. But you do want to go to Lion because Lion, increasingly, Lion is going to be needed by not Apple particularly, but by, although you can't go to Mountain Lion without Lion, but by other programs, which will take advantage of Lion features. It's only $30. I presume Apple will do the same thing with Mountain Lion, make it a very affordable. And you get it from the App Store, as you probably already know.
Mm-hmm.
So preparing the truth is, unless something goes wrong, it's a very straightforward, easy thing to do. Normally, I say up upgrading your operating system is something that you should, you back up everything, erase the hard drive, start over. But Apple has done a very good job in the last few upgrades of making it that you could upgrade in place. That's how I ended up doing it. I installed Lion on probably a dozen Macs and never had problem one. And I did it via, just the App Store upgrade. So what I would certainly do is back up your personal data. Back up anything you don't want to lose. But I think you can safely then go to the App Store, spend $30, and make the upgrade. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, all that jazz. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number if you want to talk about tech. I'd love to talk about it with you. 888-827-5536. So I said I would talk a little bit about Windows 8, the consumer preview. I had played with the developer preview when it came out a couple of months ago, and frankly was a little concerned. I wanted to hold back a little bit. I didn't want to say right up front, this is terrible, because I realized it was a very early developer preview, although Microsoft said it's feature complete. This is what it's going to look like. But I said, I'm not going to slam this. I did express some concern, however, that Microsoft, by making Windows really, their goal has clearly been, they said, Windows Reimagined. But what they clearly wanted to do is release a version of Windows that worked equally well on desktop and tablet. So a very touch-centric version of Windows. And the most visible part of that, of course, was the new Start screen. Microsoft replacing the Start menu, that button in the lower right or lower left of your computer screen, with a full screen Start screen that looks very much like Windows Phone. It had tiles for apps. You could add tiles, move tiles around, change the tiles. So the apps you use the most would be tiled. These tiles would be live tiles. So if you have, for instance, a weather tile, it would show the current weather where you are on that Start screen. And I was really skeptical. I thought, well, I don't really think this is such a good idea. Shouldn't you have software that is best optimized for the hardware you're using? If you're using a desktop, it should look one way. If you're using a touchscreen, it should look another way. And I just felt like that's a hard thing to do. What Microsoft wanted to do is difficult. And I have to say now, and I'm going to be fair, again, we're still just looking at a preview. This isn't the release version. Microsoft says the release version will be coming out probably late summer. I'm impressed. There's going to be a lot of howling, I got to tell you, because people who love the desktop are going to hate the Start screen. It's unclear at this point whether you'll be able to turn the Start screen off. I suspect there'll be a way to do that in business so that people will always start with a desktop. The desktop, but when I say desktop, I mean the old style desktop that you have on Windows 7 and everything before it, is still there. There's a recycle bin. There's a little task menu. There is no Start menu, however. They have eliminated the Start menu, and they've replaced it with some touch-centric tools that I think people will quickly get used to, even when using mouse and keyboard. One of Microsoft's goals with Windows 8 is to have everything that you could do in Windows 8 could be done with mouse, keyboard, or touch. That there's nothing you could do, or there's nothing you couldn't do with all three. So I think that in that sense, I would say this has worked. I'm impressed by the look and feel. It is very different. And, anytime you make a big change, people are going to hate it. The buttons are big because they're touch compatible, right? And I think in some ways Microsoft is saying, look, we believe the future is on tablets, not on the desktop. We'll continue to support the desktop, but we believe the future is in tablets. Certainly tablets have been very successful for Apple. I guess what I'd like to what I'd really like to say is this is better than I thought. I really expected something far worse. And this is actually surprisingly functional, useful. I think it looks pretty good. That's an aesthetic judgment that some will disagree with. The big square tiles, the kind of primary color interface, some will say is not very refined. It's not very elegant. Mac users in particular will say that. But there are some wonderful things. For instance, it automatically, when you set it up, it logs into your Windows Live account if you've got one, and will automatically populate your stuff from it. Plus, what I found, I've just installed it on a Mac. I had it on a Windows notebook computer, and the settings that I put in on the Windows notebook computer have synced over to the Mac, so I don't have to re-enter my Facebook credentials or any of that. I like that. I'll be very interested to see what the reception is. You know, anytime there's a big change, and this is the biggest change I can ever remember in Windows, to be honest. This is bigger than Windows 95, which was the last really big change. Bigger than Windows Vista or 7. Anytime you have a massive UI change, as this is, you're going to have people going, I hate it! Well, and here's the good news. You can stick with Windows 7. I don't think there'll be, and this is usually the case with Microsoft, any urgency to go to leave Windows 7. You'll have plenty of time. What'll get harder and harder as this comes out is to buy a new machine with Windows 7 installed. We saw the same thing with Windows Vista. You could get Windows Vista. You can continue to run Windows Vista. There's very little software that won't work just fine on Vista. But go ahead and try to find somebody that'll ship a new machine with Vista on it anymore. This is, I'm sure, under the hood, very much like Windows 7. So I think any Windows 7 app will run just fine. If you have a Windows 7 business, it'll continue that way. One of the things that really surprised me, Microsoft also released a preview of Windows Server, the high-end, you know, hardcore sysadmin-style operating system. It also has this user interface. That may be the biggest thing Microsoft said, or unwritten thing Microsoft said. If they're putting this interface, this Metro interface, on servers too, well, I think they're pretty committed. They're all in. They're not hedging their bets. And I commend them for that. I think that's what you need to do. You can't say, well, we're going to try this out, because that's what people really say, no. But if you commit to it, if you say, no, we're going to do this, this is where we're going, you have a much better chance of succeeding with it. I love the fact that it's kind of like a phone in the sense that once you enter your Microsoft Live account credentials, and by the way, if you don't have a Windows Live account, set one up. Set it up with all of your, with your Facebook, with your Google, with everything. Get it all in there. Because just like when you get a new phone now and you log into your Google account, or if it's a Windows phone, you log into your Windows Live account, and the whole thing is set up with the contacts, the calendar, and everything, this does the same thing. It's all set up. I didn't have to do anything. It's got all my information in it. I like that. I think that's a nice feature. No additional configuration required. Somebody in the chat room saying, what about the new ugly logo? Hey, you know, I agree. It's not my favorite thing I've ever seen. The logo is kind of a window in perspective now. It's kind of strange. But hey, it's Microsoft. They get to have any logo they want. You know, we don't live in a world yet where people tell companies, hey, that logo of yours, change that. I don't like that. We don't live in that world yet. So, hey, Microsoft, knock yourself out. You want a weird logo that looks like, some window in perspective? If that's what you like, go for it. Solid color. What it really reflects, in my opinion, is the very Spartan design style of Windows 8. Not a lot of frills. Big, bold buttons, bright colors, all of that. 8888 Ask Leo. I'd love to know what you think. If you've downloaded and installed the consumer preview, I wouldn't recommend this for anybody who's not a hardcore, cutting-edge geek. But if you are and you've installed it, let me know. What do you think? Let's go to Sydney, Australia. Mark's joining us from Sydney via Skype. Hey, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How are you going?
It's going great. How are you?
Not too bad. Look, I had a question. I mean, it's about Windows, so it's a great segue. You're talking about Windows 8 and all. So, but let's go back a step.
Actually, I hear the magic sound. I took up so much time talking about Windows 8. Stay on the line, Mark. I will be with you right after these words. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Shake, shake, shake your beanbag. Everybody come on, shake your beanbag. Shake your beanbag, don't let it drop. Let's all do the beanbag rock. Hold the
I do believe that Kyle Benham is going through a second childhood.
Hold the beanbag on your knees.
My musical director. I'm sure there's something to do with it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, he's got an explanation. I don't know if I buy it. If you do enjoy the songs Kyle plays during our returns on the show, you can always find them on his Google Plus account, Kyle Benham, B-E-N-H-A-M, or on our website, techguylabs.com. We'll put it there at the end of the show. James DeRuvo taking all the show notes today, writing everything down. Techguylabs.com. That's also where you'll find things like the video from the show, the audio, previous show, and so forth. We're designing a new page. I'm very excited about it. I'll tell you more about that in a month or two. We'll go into beta test with that, but it's going to just be spectacular. Meanwhile, poor Mark, been hanging on from Sydney. It's not the middle of the night. What is it, about 8 p.m.?
No, it's 7:20 a.m. on a Sunday, so it's a beautiful day outside.
That's right. You're on the other side of the international dateline.
Yeah, we're ahead of you guys.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Well, it's great. Thank you. It's great to have somebody listening down under. I'll be down in Sydney in November. I'm excited. I'm going on a Mac Mania cruise November 7th.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll do a meetup in Sydney November 5th or 6th. Then November 7th,
yeah, cool.
We sail to Brisbane and then to New Caledonia. We're going to see the Great Barrier Reef. There's a total eclipse of the sun. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I heard you were talking to somebody else from Brisbane about a month ago.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
So, yeah, you'll have fun. Have you been here before?
I have been to Tasmania. That's
right.
It.
Right. Okay,
That's it.
That's a bit of a strange place.
That's what everybody from Sydney says. It was beautiful. We flew through Sydney, but this time I'm going to spend some time. I'm coming out early so I can spend some time. I want to go down to Bondi Beach. I want to see the Opera House. I want to climb the bridge. I want to do Sydney.
Yeah, you're going to get sore legs climbing the bridge.
Do they let anybody do that? I mean, is it like a tour?
Yeah, you can, but you can't take anything with you, obviously, because cars are driving over the bridge, and if you drop anything, like a phone or anything, well, then obviously you can cause an accident
right.
or something. So it's very strict. You hang on. You clipped on by a chain or something as you're walking, so in case you fall.
Wow.
So it's all safe. It only takes about an hour, I think.
I can't wait.
Different groups that go across.
It sounds like you'd recommend it, Mark.
I've never done it, but I've heard lots of people who have done it before.
It's like all the people who live in San Francisco have never been to Alcatraz. That's exactly it, right? It's a tourist thing. So what can I do for you, Mark, now that you've helped me with my travels?
Okay. Great program, by the way. Now,
thank you.
The reason why I rang up is because I work in IT, so I do sort of have a good understanding of what I'm trying to do, but I'm sort of stuck on this one. So I thought you and your chat room could help. I've got Windows 7 Professional Media Center Edition set up in the lounge room as my TV and media player for videos, MKV files, and whatnot. Now, good old Windows 7, it doesn't support H.264 out of the box MKV files.
Right.
So what you've got to do, because they're using Windows Media Foundation or whatever they call it, you've got to install a certain codec pack that's supported with Windows 7 that'll allow you to play MKV files. So that's where I've downloaded and installed DivX Plus Codec Pack.
Right.
Which, if you Google search that, DivX Plus Codec Pack, the first link that comes up, you can download it. It's about 20 meg-ish in size. It also suggests that you also install the AC3 filter alongside that for the audio.
Right.
So I've done that, and it works beautifully on Windows Media Center, like in the lounge room. Now, however, once you put something else into the picture, for example, a Windows Media Center extender running on an Xbox 360, then you've got problems. I'm not playing the same MKV files properly on the extender that I can see
right.
on the Media Center itself.
So let me explain a little bit about what's going on, Mark. This is something that a lot of people have gone through. It's not an unusual problem. There are two things. It's not just codecs. So there's two things you have to keep in mind when you're playing back video on a computer. There's the wrapper file. In this case, you've got MKV or Matryoshka files. AVI is another kind of wrapper. You've probably seen that. That's the Windows standard Windows wrapper. There's MOV for QuickTime. Those are the file format wrappers. And then within that, there's video and audio, each compressed with a codec, a compression decompression algorithm or codec. And you mentioned quite a few codecs there, H.264, AC3, all of those. AC3 is an audio codec, H.264 video. Those are most commonly used. In fact, DVDs use those. So they're very common. In fact, oftentimes people with Windows are able to play back H.264 because they install a DVD playing program and it adds that codec. The reason it doesn't come with Windows is because it's not a free codec. So they'd have to pay a license fee. So the issue is twofold. One, you have to have codecs for whatever format. DivX is a codec, by the way, as well as a wrapper format. So you'd have to have codecs for every kind of possible playback, and the extender has to support it as well. You know, whatever you're playing it on has to support it as well. And those things have to also support the wrapper format. And this is where people get in trouble with MKV, Matryoshka files. That's an unusual wrapper format. It's somewhat CPU intensive, and lots of times people can't play those back.
Can I just quickly tell you what's happening on the extender?
Sure.
With that DivX Plus codec pack, what that does, it streams it in such a way. So when you watch it on the extender, it actually, I think it streams it in DivX quality or something. It does something to the video. So when you watch it on the extender, like an MKV file, for example, H.264 or AC3 or whatnot, it looks beautiful on the extender. The DivX Plus codec pack does some magic to it. Now, when I download the MKV files from the net, movies and stuff will play perfectly well on the actual media center, but they won't play on the extender. Like
right.
Some of them won't play. Some of them will and some of them won't. So it's a bit hit and miss. It's not like for like.
One thing you could do is process all MKV files to take the H.264 out, because that's what's inside an MKV file, is eliminate the wrapper. That often helps. You've downloaded the DivX codec pack, but there are other codec packs. The chat room seems to like an open source, I think it's open source one called, this is the problem, is that many of these are proprietary, is CCCP. And then there's, of course, K-Lite. These have been around for a long time. I have a feeling in both cases they're violating somebody's rights, but I can't prove it, so I don't know. And what you don't know won't hurt you. And then finally, remember, the extender may not support those codecs, and there's no way to get that on the extender, right?
But that's what the DivX Plus codec pack does.
So you're not having trouble with the extender anyway. The extender's fine, except for MKV files.
Yeah, it just doesn't stream it well through properly. I mean, my other option is to grab an old laptop, which is fairly decent, still sitting in the garage. Yeah. It's just in a box in a garage. I could probably get that out and just put Windows Media Center on it and just get away with the extender altogether.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend. You notice they stopped making extenders.
Yeah, right, okay.
And that's why.
Probably for this reason.
Because they're dumb. They don't have a lot of CPU, and they can't really be, improved. So you kind of stuck with what they can do. So you basically would turn that laptop into a home theater PC, and you'd have then no problem playing anything back. Incidentally, Windows Media Player is probably not going to appear on 8. We'll talk about that when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. We were talking about Windows Media Center, which is, of course, a very popular way to turn a Windows computer into a home theater PC. And our last caller, Mark from Sydney, was using it, and I think it's a great solution. However, there's been some question about whether Microsoft would include Windows Media Center in Windows 8. It is in the consumer preview. It's running exactly the same. In fact, I think it's the same program as on Windows 7. Steven Sanofsky confirmed on a blog post on that Windows 8, running Windows 8 blog, that Media Center will be included as an app. So it is in this consumer preview. It will be an app running. So I think it's really more for downward compatibility purposes, because I don't think Microsoft really... He says they're working hard to improve the quality and compatibility of add-ins for the Media Center, to Mark's point. It turns out, though, that only 6% of Windows 7 users ever launched Windows Media Center. They keep telemetry on this stuff. Microsoft knows when you launch Media Center, and only 6% of Windows 7 users ever use it. Most of the people who use Windows Media Center are in Russia, Mexico, and Brazil. Now, the fact that Sinofsky is saying this tells me that they're kind of pushing away from this a little bit. They killed the Windows Media Extenders. Only a quarter of the 6% who launched Windows Media Center on Windows 7 used it for more than 10 minutes. 59% used it for less than a minute. Probably they launched it by accident. Or maybe they were just saying, what's this? Windows Media Player is heavily used. 68% of Windows users use it. Internet Explorer launched by 88%. So when you see 6% use, I think when Microsoft says that, what they're really saying is, yeah, we're going to include it. Don't expect much. This was in Steven's Building Windows 8 blog. If you want to know what's going on with Windows 8, this is where everybody goes to read the tea leaves. Steven Sinofsky, who's in charge of Windows 8 development for Microsoft, does big, long blog posts here on the MSDN blog. Just if you Google Building Windows 8, you'll find it. And it's certainly the only information we're getting about Windows 8. He's really keeping it all close to the vest. But as I said, I'm liking it so far. I am enjoying it. Tom in Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing, sir? Thank you much.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
My Printspooler. I got Windows 7 Professional. It's on a Toshiba laptop, and my Printspooler, you know, I start it up, I can see the icons, but it says when I click on a printer, it says it's not running.
Wow. I love these kinds of questions. I don't know. Probably what I would do if I were you is I would first of all make sure you've got the latest driver for your particular printer. Uninstall the old driver, reinstall the new one. These are for some reason, printing on Windows especially is just a mess. Update the drivers is about the only fix I know. Uninstall, reinstall. Edmonton Oiler guy in our chat room is saying, IT guys hate printers. It's true. It's really true. This is the call the IT guy hates. And, of course, the first question, Kate Botello, my old co-host. She wasn't old. She was a young lady co-host on the old show, The Screensavers, used to always. She worked in IT for years. She'd say, well, is it plugged in? That's the first question. Yeah, the Printspooler's not running. Not sure why. Best thing you can do is reinstall and hope it works. If you got if it's an HP printer, HP gives you this huge package, right, that you install all that stuff. That's what I would get. Go to the HP site, get that, and start over, reinstall that. If you can uninstall it first, then reinstall it. And don't call me with your PC load letter problems. No, I don't want to hear it. Tom, that's all I can say. That's one of those things that probably really is not solvable over the radio. Andy, Washington, D.C., Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Andy.
So I have to let you know that I grew up with a Xerox computer running CPM.
Wow. I didn't even know Xerox made CPM computers. Wow, that's cool.
Yes, way back in the day.
Way back when.
So here's my question. I'm working with an organization where there's a committee that's reviewing lots and lots of documents, and right now it's all paper. What they want to do is move to a paperless situation. And so the first question is, how well do PDFs render on a Kindle, or is there a better type of device to do that? And I guess the second question then would be, what is the easiest way to distribute all these documents, especially considering that some of these are legal documents that need to be kept secure?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, if you're scanning documents in, you know, pleadings and so forth, it's a legal organization. That's probably mostly what you're doing. And most scanners will save them as PDFs. In effect, what you're really doing is saving a picture of that document. And on a computer, that's going to be a pretty accurate rendition of the document. On the Kindle, ick. Because the Kindle is, first of all, doesn't have the resolution, does it? Are you taking it from a printed document, or are you going to start with a digital document?
It's going to be a mixture. Some of these are documents that were sent to us electronically as PDFs or as maybe Word documents, and some of them we will be scanning in.
So the Kindle doesn't read PDFs natively, but you can email a PDF to the Kindle or run it through some software, convert it to the Kindle format. If the original is a digital file, it will do a better job of rendering it, although not perfectly. Paragraph breaks sometimes get messed up and so forth. I've never seen PDFs look very good on Kindles. And then it's a Kindle e-book, you know, e-ink, or is it a Kindle Fire?
We don't know. We haven't decided on what device to go. So if there's even a better device.
Well, the Fire you'd have much better shot at. The resolution is much higher. It's color. It's more like it's a tablet.
Yeah.
So when I'm answering this question, I'm answering it primarily for the e-ink screens, everything but the Fire. On the e-ink, you're going to have a very poor experience, particularly with scanned documents, because it just doesn't have the resolution to display that image. With the Kindle, I think it's going to be okay. Now, if you go to an iPad 3, where you're going to have a lot of resolution, then I think it would work well.
Cool. So basically, hold off for a little while, see what's coming down the pipe.
Next week, yeah. If they do, as I'm sure they will, a Retina display, that 2048 by 1536, that is enough to get a great image from the scanned documents. So if you've got good-looking PDFs, that will be the way to do it, better than a Kindle. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It is. It's turning into a song. You know that sound? You don't hear that anymore, do you?
Printer jam.
Thank you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Printer jammed. Thank you. It's I apologize, Scott Wilkinson. I forgot you.
Oh, that's not a problem at all.
Usually you join us in the chat room, and I didn't see you there, and I thought, well, maybe he's taking the day off. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, no, I wasn't taking the day off. I actually had quite a lot going on this morning.
So it's not entirely my fault.
It is not entirely your fault. I do not want you to think that one little bit.
Can you talk to us now?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Scott's our home theater guru, and we hate to pass a day without Scott. He's the online editor for Home Theater Magazine at hometheater.com, and joins us every week when Leo doesn't forget to talk about home theater.
That's right. And there's always so much to talk about. We've got, I'm so happy to answer questions on the website. I get more email than I can deal with, unfortunately.
Well, pick a couple from the website. I've got a commercial, so do one, and I'll do a commercial, and you come back and do the other one. How about that? That
sounds great. Unfortunately, my computer is going very slow.
Is that part of the problem you've been having today, Scott?
No. Oh. Well, not that I thought I knew of.
Just add that to the list, Scott.
I
got to
add that to the list. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me just quickly.
That is, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, the universal error message sound. Oh,
yes. Here's one for you.
I got one for you. Wait a minute. Let me ask you one.
All right.
You know what? I'm always let everybody else ask you the questions. So
ask me a question.
As you know, I have I think 3 or 4 year old. I have 2 Pioneer plasmas. Yep. I have the Kuro, and that ain't going anywhere. But
no.
But I have an older Pioneer. I think it was a 5060. So it was not even an Elite plasma.
Right.
So it's maybe
before the Kuro days.
It was before pre-Kuro, and they were doing Elites. It was like the year before is Elite that's how they did it. They make it Elite. And then the next year, they'd sell the Elite as the less Elite as the new Elite came out.
Right, because the new Elite would have more.
It was better than the old Elite.
Yeah, right.
In other words, this thing is, I don't know, it's 4 or 5 years old. Is it time? Right. It looks fine, but it's not, you know, it doesn't look as great as some of the newer. You're on a Samsung D8000 here, and I'm just thinking, gosh, that looks good. Is it time? When do you upgrade a plasma TV?
You know, this is a fabulous question, and in fact, it's the poll question I asked last week.
Oh.
Which is, how often have you replaced your TV in the last 10 years?
I swear I didn't know it.
And the reason is because it used to be, I remember when I was growing up, people kept their TVs 15, 20, 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and nowadays it seems like they're upgrading a lot faster. The replacement rate is a lot faster.
Well, what's changed is the TVs are changing faster.
Yes, I mean, right.
And that's what I kind of am asking is how, look, the TV still looks fine, but would I get a much better experience if I got a newer TV? I have a Roku box attached to it, a Boxy box attached to it, so I have, you know, internet access. The TV in those days didn't have internet access. But would I get a better picture? Would it be worth upgrading?
Well, yes, you probably would get a better picture. I would say that.
Is the plasma worn out? Is it getting dim?
No. No. No, I don't think so. Plasmas are typically rated at 30,000 in the old days it was 30,000. Now it's more like 60,000 hours.
Wow. So that's like 20 years of 8 hours a day.
That's like 20 years at 8 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Plenty of time.
So my general advice to your question is no, there's no reason to replace it if it's working fine.
Darn it.
And you go, darn.
Oh,
darn.
All right. Yeah, no, it looks fine. It looks really good. I'm just, you know, because it's not side by side with the more modern TV, I don't know if maybe the colors aren't as great.
Exactly. And that's what we do when we review TVs. We put them side by side with ones we know are really good so we can see little tiny differences. But in isolation, all by itself, you don't see, you know, you can't tell that it's not quite as good as the latest and greatest.
So on your poll, were people upgrading?
Yes, people were upgrading. I asked, how often have you replaced your TV in the last 10 years? I said once, never, 2 or 3 times, 4 or 5 times, more than 5 times. Now, I voted more than 5 times only because I'm a reviewer.
You're not fair. That's not fair. You're not
a
typical
fair.
User.
No, I'm skewing the results, but I'm only one person.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
It's not that bad. The once and the 2 or 3 times are just about neck and neck and the most that people have replaced their TVs in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I've done it once, and that was the one that I'm talking about, and that was that was a big upgrade for me. Here's the poll results, and as you said, it's kind of evenly tied between once or 2 or 3 times. That represents 81% of all responses.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. You'll notice the graphic I put up at the top is an old ad with George Burns and the
Look out, Gracie, with the Genius Space Command TV. I could check. This must have been the first remote control.
Exactly, and it was an ultrasonic remote.
I remember.
It was not IR. It actually created an ultrasonic pulse that moved the channel up or
In
down.
In fact, it felt very weird when you pushed it. It kind of went phoom.
Yeah. In fact, that's where the term clicker comes from. You've heard remotes called clickers?
It was a clicker.
Because they actually clicked.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
So
nothing
anyway,
between you and the set but space. Nothing
I
between
thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, this is good.
And I used that as my graphic because I used as my hook for the story that I remembered growing up, my grandparents had a Space Command Zenith TV with one of these clicker remotes. And, you know, I remember that all through my childhood. And now people don't keep their TVs that long.
So the poll this week, by the way, is how often do you use your home theater system for anything but watching TV, right?
Well, it's do you use it more for watching movies and TV, or do you use it more for music?
Right.
And the reason I ask that is the two functions are somewhat different and have somewhat different requirements. Mm. And so if you only have one system, which most of us do, then you need to decide which one is more important to you and balance your system accordingly. For example, if you listen only to music, you'd probably want full-range speakers in the front. Most audiophiles, when they listen to two-channel music, because most recorded music is two-channel, they will not use a subwoofer. They'll use full-range front left and right speakers. Whereas with a theater, you actually have a lot more really low-frequency material with explosions and rockets and dinosaurs and so on. So you really do need a subwoofer more than you do when you're listening to music.
Right.
So I was curious to know whether our readers listen all to music or all to movies or mostly one or the other or about equal. And result was kind of interesting, too. I only posted that on Friday. So
well, so it's not over. Let me just send people there. Hometheater.com. So, all right, you said you had a question. We have about a minute and a half left. You got a quickie?
Here we go. All yeah. right. Are you familiar with HDMI audio return channel?
No idea what that is.
Okay. Well, HDMI is a type of connection that you connect from your source device to your TV or to your receiver and then to your TV. It carries audio and video digitally. The newest version, HDMI 1.4, actually lets you send audio back from the TV to the receiver.
Well, hang on, and we'll find out why the heck you would want to do that when we continue. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, with Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy. We get that instead of a new car. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Talking computers, the internet, home theater, cell phones, all of that jazz at 8888. Ask Leo, that's the phone number. We held Scott Wilkinson over because we started talking about bi-directional HDMI. And I had to find out what that was all about before we went on. Scott Wilkinson is our home theater wizard. He's the online editor for Home Theater Magazine at hometheater.com. He also does a Home Theater Geeks podcast. It's called Home Theater Geeks for the hardcore home theater fan. He does that every Monday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern on my podcast network, twit.tv. In fact, last week, your 100th episode. Congratulations.
Yep. Thank you very much.
And you had an amazing guest. You had the Alan Parsons of the Alan Parsons Project, a studio engineer for the Beatles, Pink Floyd, and many other great bands. Boy, that must have been fascinating.
It was amazing. It was really, really great. He actually gave us a tour of his studio in his home, and what do you know? He's got B&W 802s.
Those are the speakers right I've always drooled over.
Mm-hmm. No. That's exactly right.
So and you he can hear that at twit.tv/HTG, and it's a full hour interview, so there's lots to hear.
Yeah, yeah. You and I interviewed him at CES for about 15
minutes.
That
was fun,
which was really fun. But here we had a whole hour to talk about a lot of different stuff. He gave us some reminiscences of working with the Beatles and with Pink Floyd and this new box set that has his original quadraphonic mix of Dark Side of the Moon on it. So it's a great show. I really highly recommend it.
Home Theater Geeks. I highly recommend that. Now, before the top of the hour, we were talking a little bit about something, an audio return channel in HDMI. So the HDMI video cable, you know, your DVD, for instance, has it out, and you plug it into the back of the TV set or your Xbox 360 or your PlayStation 3.
HDMI output, right. They all have HDMI outputs, and they go either directly into the TV or into your AV receiver, into your audio system.
Which is a better way to do it. Because then you can have the AV receiver do all the switching and so forth.
Correct. That is correct. And a lot of people do it differently, and I'm always a little flummoxed as to why that might be. They just probably don't understand, which is why they write me and I set them straight. So this fellow who wrote me was doing exactly that. He was taking his HDMI from his PlayStation 3, hooking it directly into his TV, and then hooking also the HDMI output from his receiver into another input on his HDTV, and trying to use this new feature called Audio Return Channel to send the audio from the PS3 through the TV and back to his receiver. Well, that was kind of bass-ackwards, if you catch my drift on that. But let me first explain Audio Return Channel real quick. It's a new feature of HDMI 1.4, which is the latest version. Basically, what it's for is this. If you've got your HDMI cable going from your receiver to your TV, that's all well and good. It's sending digital video. It's sending digital audio to the TV. But what about when you use the internal tuner of your TV, say, for over-the-air broadcasts or for online streaming from Netflix or any of a number of providers? That content is coming directly into the TV. How do you get the audio from that content out to your audio system, your 5.1 surround system? In the past, you've had to take a Toslink optical cable or a coax cable and send it from the TV back to the receiver using a separate cable. With HDMI 1.4 and Audio Return Channel, that cable is no longer needed. The audio can be sent back from the TV through the cable in the opposite direction the signal normally goes, back to the receiver. As long as the receiver is compatible with Audio Return Channel, then it will play that audio from the TV's built-in tuner over the air or cable even, or the online apps without having that extra cable making more techno spaghetti behind your system. So that's actually a really cool feature. That's a good thing. But what this guy, Dan, wanted to do was kind of make the audio coming into one HDMI output go back out another HDMI input via Audio Return Channel. And I kind of scratched my head and I went, well, that's really not necessary. Just connect your PS3 to one of the inputs on your AV receiver, which is Audio Return Channel compatible. He has a Pioneer. And just be done with it. You know, you'd be able to hear everything just fine. He was only getting stereo. And he says, why can't I get multi-channel? Well, it could be that the Panasonic TV that he's using filters the audio coming in, going back out to the Audio Return Channel only to stereo. I don't really know. Didn't have time to do research on that. But I just wanted to bring it up because Audio Return Channel is actually very cool, especially with online apps. You know, maybe you're using your internal tuner with an over-the-air antenna, or maybe not, but more and more people are using online apps for Netflix and Vudu and Hulu and YouTube and so on and so forth. And if you want to hear the audio from that, from your TV,
makes sense.
Audio Return Channel is the way to go.
So it's for these smart TVs that have built-in internet access. I've got one for review that you're on, and you look great, by the way.
And yeah, it's the new Samsung. Right?
Yeah. And so
has a great TV.
It's a good TV. You know, I think that they still have a ways to go with the apps. And the problem is, of course, it's built in. The Smart Hub is built into the TV. So you're kind of tied to whatever they do.
Correct.
You know, on the other hand, then you could do picture in picture and stuff like that. I think that it's early yet. This is the new stuff, right?
It's early. Yeah. I just last week saw a demonstration of the latest version of that from Samsung, and they've improved the interface some, and it's taken a while there to do something there.
Yeah, you're blocked because it said I tried to go to the Samsung apps and it says network interference, can't do it. And of course, I don't know why that would be. Everything else works. So it's just, you know, it's things like that. You don't really want your TV to be stuck in a loop with a rotating ball saying connecting.
Right.
And so there's something to be said for not having your TV be a computer. We're just going to bring all the new problems to TVs that computers have.
Well,
right?
But you can get it. You can get those online apps in most Blu-ray players these days, as well as TVs, game consoles, as well as computers. So I think the point here is that the manufacturers did not want consumers to have to deal with computers per se. And so they wanted to kind of make it more like an appliance. And so that's why they have these apps and it's very restricted. Stuff like that.
I would wait to the next generation. Yeah, because it's basically hung up now. And if I were watching the big game and right. I now were hung up as it was trying to connect to the internet, I would not be happy.
I would not be a happy camper.
An unhappy camper. Scott Wilkinson, you could follow him on online at hometheater.com and every week on this show talking about home theater. And we got to plan a full day again with you. We haven't done it in a couple of months, and I'd love to get you on.
Oh, I'd love to. Maybe instead of Norway.
Maybe instead of Norway. It's, you know, if you can't have Norway, at least you can have Scott. Thank you, Scott. Don't forget, who's on Home Theater Geeks on Monday?
Ah, Monday is John Schindler, the Vice President of Product Development at Vizio.
Ooh.
So we're going to hear all about what's new at Vizio, and they are doing some pretty interesting things, including cinema-wide 21:9 or 2.35:1 super widescreen flat panel TVs.
Vizio is an interesting company because they're not the top-tier company like a Pioneer or an LG or a Sharp or a Samsung, but they make very affordable products that are quite good, and you see them in
that
the big box
quite
stores.
Good. Yeah. I think they're the value leader, really, in the industry.
Yeah, I would agree. Thank you, Scott. We'll talk again real soon.
You bet.
Hometheater.com. He is the geek. And I've somehow broken my TV now because it's just sitting there connecting. You know, it's a beautiful TV, and I wouldn't say don't buy the TV, because just don't use the smart apps would be my recommendation. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're going to go back to the phones in just a moment. You stay right here. Portion of the Tech Guy Show brought to you by my friend. It really doesn't want to stay upright, does it? All right, there we go. Brought to my friends at stamps.com. I got the stamps.com USB scale right here. This is such a cool thing. If you go right now to stamps.com, let me just type this in, stamps.com, you can find out about a really wonderful service. I've been using them for almost a decade now, believe it or not. It lets you buy and print official U.S. postage from your computer and your printer. You don't need special inks. You don't need a postage meter. You've got the capability. The post office loves it. In fact, they love it so much they give stamps.com some kind of special treatment. You will never again wait in line at the post office, which is a good thing, because they've got, you know, the stamps are going up. Post offices are closing. Why wait in line when you could just bring the post office right to your desk with stamps.com? So here's the idea. So you've got the scale. You plug it in. It's a USB scale. You plug it into your computer. You've got packages to mail. You put it on the scale. Prints out perfect, exactly the right postage. Even if it's an international package, they'll do the right international postage. They'll even fill out all the forms for you automatically from your address book. If you use QuickBooks, invoices, same thing, automatically pulls from QuickBooks. If you're an Amazon seller or an eBay seller, this is just a boon for you. All of your posts. And then, and this is the beauty part, the mail carrier just picks it up and takes it. You can even make an appointment free. There's no charge. So you don't have to even get up from your desk. They'll come to you, they'll say, give me the package, and you're all ready to go. Discounts, too, that you can't get to the post office, up to 21% off express mail, 15% off on priority mail. You've got to try this. I've got an offer that is so good, you're probably not going to believe it. If you go to the stamps.com main page, you will see an $80 offer. But if you go to stamps.com, click the radio microphone up here and put my name in, Leo, you will see a $110 offer. So make sure you click the radio microphone, because here's what you're going to get. You're going to get the scale, the USB scale, free, yours to keep, $50 value. You're going to get $55 in free postage coupons. Now, that's a real deal. Yes, you can mail using third class. Of course you can. You could do anything you could do at the post office, you could do at stamps.com, Mac or PC. You'll also get a four-week trial and a $5 supplies kit, and there's no cost to you at all. But you got to use my name, Leo. You only pay shipping and handling. Stamps.com, a no-risk trial offer worth $110 right now. Never go to the post office again, and we thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy Show. Oh, don't use Leo. I'm sorry. This is a Tech Guy show. What show is this? Use Tech Guy. Let's get some credit for the Tech Guy. Forget that Leo guy. Tech Guy is the offer code. See, it says so right on the screen. Use Tech Guy. His sister Pam works in a shop.
I fixed the TV and Scott came back. That's just bizarre.
I'm in your TV.
It was. You saw it though. It was stuck. It was going rotating, connecting.
Yeah.
And so I had to turn it off, and then I turn it on again, and then that fixed it. But I don't think this is where they. I think they've got a ways to go. And I love the idea. You know, I use a Roku, a BoxyBox, an Apple TV, a Google TV, the Logitech Review, and I love them all in their own way, their unique ways. Blu-ray player, same thing.
Yep.
But now I have to log in, apparently. So you were on the TV, and now it's a login screen. I didn't do anything. So this is my problem. When for some reason when it's built into the TV, it just feels like it's not maybe the best way to implement that.
I tend to agree.
But anyway. It's early yet, and they're gonna get better. And so I love the TV. In fact, I you notice I haven't returned it yet. But I will. Let's see. Log in. So you shouldn't have to log in to use a TV. Thank you, Scott. No, appreciate it.
You bet, Leo. Talk care. To you later.
I fixed the TV and it's Scott. that was just weird. Back to the phones we go. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Brian's in Reno. Our next caller. Hi, Brian. Leo here.
Hey, Leo. Hey, first of all, I've got a Vizio Razr that has a Twit TV app on it.
Oh, that's the Vizio TV. Now, that is true. We are now it's probably not updated because I think the company that made that app has now changed their business plan. So you're probably not getting the latest shows.
Through Yahoo on the
right.
Vizio. But
we're working on a new Yahoo widget for that Vizio. That's another issue, by the way, that's doesn't affect users, but it certainly affects us as a content creator. Is we have to create apps for each of these TVs. So now I have to write a Samsung app. I have to have a Vizio app. I have to have a Yahoo app. I have to have a Popcorn Hour app, a Roku, Boxy. Every single device has to, and they're all a little bit different.
Everyone's different. That's
yeah.
right.
So it's a little tough for content creators. It's in a way, I don't like this because it you know, if you're ABC, CBS, and Disney, you got no problem. But if you're Leo Laporte, well, that can add up.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Anyway, I apologize, Matt. We are working on another Yahoo widget. We've got a great programmer who's done a lot of good things for us. He did the Android app, the iPhone app, and the iPad app. His company is called Shift Key Software, Craig Mullaney. He's in our chat room. Great guy. And I think it's on his list. Right, Craig?
I got to tell you, your iPad app and your Android app and everything else works great. So.
That's Craig. Anyway, that's Craig. He did our Roku app, too. Yeah, he's great.
My question is, Sprint has finally limited my 5G. It used to be unlimited on my Wi-Fi hotspot.
Yep.
Now they're going to start charging me over 5 gig. They're going to start charging me.
And you know what? It's interesting because we had... last week we had the guy on, he called in, who sued AT&T and won $850 because they throttled his quote unlimited. Well, so ever since that happened, AT&T has announced, oh, well, I guess we're not going to do unlimited anymore.
Right.
So they're all doing this. Now Sprint was making a big deal about not having a limit.
Well, let me tell you, the phone itself is still unlimited. The hotspot through 4G is now limited to 5 gigs. So
I think that makes sense. Now, if you think about it, why did they do that? Well, because otherwise you'd use them as your internet service provider at home.
And that's what I do because I drive around the country. Yeah, that's all I have.
That's your internet.
So that is my internet.
Well,
so,
here's the good news. 5 gig is a lot for mobile. It's not a lot for home.
Not when you're averaging 35 to 45 gig of television shows and movies every month.
Yeah, but you're using it as your... Now, see, I have sympathies on both sides. On the one hand, that's the internet. That's what you want, and you're mobile, so this is perfect. On the other hand, right. I kind of sympathize with Sprint because they never intended it to be your, not merely, you know, data on a phone, but your home internet access and your television network.
Absolutely not, but it sure does work great when it works.
I know, and that's their fault for making too good of a 4G service.
Yeah, so.
Do they offer you a higher level? Can you say, well, I'd like to buy more?
For $79.99 a month, you can get 12 gig.
That's still not enough. You know, that's what I pay for my 30 megabit down Comcast, and that's a 250 gig limit. So They're overcharging.
If I had a 3,000 mile cable or a 3,000 mile,
you got no choice, right?
That'd be great.
Yeah, you have no choice. So I guess what you could do, Brian, is buy some of those little MiFi cards. You know, the credit card size hotspot things, and have three or four of them, and keep track of it. And after the week one, use the first one. Week two, use the second one. Week three, in other words, piggyback them. Now it's going to end up costing you more.
Yeah, but then you still, so what I want to do is, since my phone is still unlimited, I want to be able to download my TV shows and my movies to my phone and just transfer them over to my iPad or my laptop. Is there any service or is there any iTunes that'll go on an Android app?
Yeah, in fact, many of these new Android phones have what's called DLNA built in. And your TV, if it has DLNA like this Samsung does, will see the phone. I can get things on my phone and then just play them back from the phone on the TV. It doesn't use any bandwidth. So,
I have the Evo 4G, so it's a little bit older.
Yeah, I don't know about the Evo. You can, of course, Evo may have I bet it does have an HDMI cable capability, so you could connect it HDMI. And, yes, you can buy movies a good example is the Google market, Android market. They've got movies and TV shows. You can buy them, download them there using your phone, which is still unlimited. Sprint's making a lot of hay about that. And then it's going to be downloaded into a folder, which I think you should be able to see when you use a USB cable to connect your Evo to your computer. I don't know what kind of copy protection they put on there. That may be the fly in the ointment. If they have it set up so that you have to play it on your phone. In that case, get the HDMI cable, and I think that would be the best way to do that. It's really, you're the, Brian, you have my sympathy, but you see now why this is a really big issue for mobile carriers. As more and more people do what Brian's doing, they want to use their mobile phone as their whole internet access, and start downloading hundreds of gigabytes of data a month. And the problem is that the mobile network really doesn't support that very well. The way it works to get data to your cell phone is a cell carrier has to run a bandwidth connection out to each cell site. So when you're on a cell site, you're using that cell site's internet connection. And in most cases, they don't, this is very costly. In most cases, they also don't have a lot of bandwidth out there, maybe a megabit and a half. So if you've upgraded to 4G, now they've got to put more, I think it's 20 megabits out there. And you can see how it adds up. And so they have a choice. They can either be honest and say, it's not unlimited. It's very limited. And if you want more, you're going to pay for it. Or they can say it's unlimited, crossing their fingers behind their back. And if you use too much, they send you a letter saying, stop it. It's not unlimited. We lied. It's a challenge. They're going to have to solve this because there's more and more of us like Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You can't always get what you want. But I think if you got a more modern phone and use that DLNA, you're actually in a good position because you got the relatively unlimited bandwidth. Yeah, there's secret limits, which is annoying. I should probably, I did the stamps.com, but have I told you about Gazelle? This is a good time.
Gazelle out.
The reason it's a good time is because we got an iPad coming, okay, right? And the price, as the iPad 3 is announced on Wednesday, the price of an iPad 2 or an iPad 1 will plummet, the resale price, right? Because so now is the time. In fact, Tom Merritt asked me this. It was so funny. He said, I know I'm buying an iPad 3. Should I go to Gazelle right now and sell my iPad 2? And my answer is yes. In general, yes. Don't wait because the prices are not going to go up. They're only going to go down. Let's see right now. If you have an iPad 2, let's just go to gazelle.com. This is mine. It's a 64 gig. Oh, it's not Wi-Fi though. Wait a minute. Mine is a iPad 2.
It's a 64 gig Wi-Fi plus 3G Verizon. This is my iPad too. Just out of curiosity. Ooh, that's nice. That's nice. Now, that's if it's got good. If it's flawless, goes up. So you see it varies. And if it's broken, it's not worth anything. Even if it's broken, it's $83 with a cracked screen. That's interesting. But let's say it's in good condition. Now, here's the beauty part. You can get a check, PayPal, or get an Amazon gift card, and they will give you an extra 5%. So that's another $6.60, right? So it's now 30, what is it? 33.60. Now, here's the other part of this. If you got more stuff to sell, you just keep entering it in. Let's say, how about that Evo? That Sprint Evo, right? Let's sell that sucker. Is it functional? Absolutely. Great shape. Got all the stuff? Yep. Free of water damage? Of course, I've died. So let's see what that's just. This would be the best case scenario. $51. So we throw that in the box. That's $50 you didn't have before. You throw that in the box. You keep throwing it. They pay the postage on every gadget worth more than a buck, and you get cash, PayPal, Walmart card, or get that Amazon card for 5% more. GAZELLE.com. Now's the time to get that iPad 2 off your hands. Get the iPad 3. And, you know, it really subsidizes it. This is so much easier. And if you've got a drawer, as I do, in fact, I have it right here, filled with stuff, get rid of that stuff today. Don't sell it. Gazelle it. GAZELLE.com and get cash for your gadgets. And by the way, if it isn't worth anything, if it's like just completely, you could, I'm going to do this because I have stuff that's 10 years old. They will recycle it for you. And they do it in a green way. No landfill, no overseas shipping. They take care of it. If it's time to upgrade, it's time to Gazelle. GAZELLE.com. Don't sell it. Gazelle it. Now's the time, too. Stream. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. They're asking what the S stands for in the chat room. We have a great conversation. You know, when we're in commercials, the chat room and I kind of go back and forth. We converse. You can get in there, by the way. Go to the website, techguylabs.com, and click the chat link. 927 people in there. So it goes by fast, but it's, you know, it's a lot of fun. So we were conversing. What does the S stand for in the iPhone 4S? A lot of people think it stands for Steve because Steve Jobs passed away shortly before it was announced. Like, actually, no, he just passed away the day after it was announced, but he was very ill, right? So they thought iPhone for Steve. But remember, the iPhone, when it went from the 3G, the next generation was the 3GS. So, and Apple's not saying. I don't know what the S stands for. Maybe Siri? I don't know. We will see, I am sure. I've mentioned this earlier in the show. A new iPad. It's coming out on, well, it will be announced on Wednesday, March 7th. Apple's having an event. They invited all the Tame press to that event, the press that likes Apple to that event, and we will be sitting on the sidelines here at twit.tv starting at 9:30 Pacific, 12:30 Eastern, twit.tv for our live coverage of that event. Apple does not stream these events, but there are enough people in there typing away so that you really can, it's almost live. So what we do is we do like a base, you know how they reenact baseball games? We reenact the keynote so you can kind of follow along. I expect we'll see a Retina display, very high-quality display. It may not be called the iPad 3. Somebody in the chat room said maybe the iPad HD. You know what? That's actually a good name. I could see them calling him that. Rumor mill is pretty strong that it will be the same price. That's generally what Apple does. They don't increase the prices of their products. They increase the power. I expect, and this is my own speculation, that they will continue to sell an iPad 2 at a lower price because they are getting a little bit of competition at the low end from people like Amazon with the Kindle Fire. So I think somewhere in the $300 to $400 range, probably $350, my guess, iPad 2, you know, cutting the cost $150 of an iPad 2 by a third is I think, a great move. And certainly would be welcomed by education and others. And it would help make that iPad culture even stronger. They're doing so well, aren't they? High-res screen on the iPad 3 or the iPad HD. I hope a better camera. We don't know what else it will have. There are some rumors, too. There will be a new Apple TV announced at the same time with high def as well. Why not go all HD?
So I like that. I like that idea. This is pure speculation. This is nobody knows. Apple doesn't say, but I like the idea. They'll call it the iPad HD, and they'll release the Apple TV HD at the same time. What do you think? I like that. I think that's a good idea. Paul in Virginia Beach, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I love all your shows.
Thank you.
Listen, I had a question. I was trying to find out how to set up a way to prevent packet sniffing.
So let's talk about what packet sniffing is, first of all, is that people who have access to your network traffic can watch it go by. Everything that goes on the Internet or on your local area network in your office or on your Wi-Fi, if you have wireless, is transmitted in little chunks of data called packets. Packet sniffers actually take that data and try to analyze it, sometimes to the degree that they can actually see the contents of it and say, oh, there's his password, there's his email. Is that what you're worried about?
Yeah. You know, I do the best I can when I surf the net and I stay safe and all that stuff, and I clean my computer frequently, and I was just trying to be as safe as possible. That's all.
So, is it Wi-Fi that you're worried about, or?
Yeah, well, I have Wi-Fi on the computer, obviously, but I just want to make sure that you know, that everything is secure as it can be.
Right. Well, here's the problem, of course. As soon as you're sending data in the clear, unencrypted, whoever has access to the data can sniff it. So here's what you need to do. You need to encrypt the data for as far as you want it to be secure. If you have Wi-Fi, well, you want to turn on encryption on your Wi-Fi access spot. By the way, most modern Wi-Fi access spots have very good, reliable encryption. It's called WPA. I recommend you use WPA2. That will secure the packets that fly through the air. There is, unfortunately, a well-known bug with routers that support something called WPS, which is a wireless protected setup. It's a very easy way to set up this WPA networking. Unfortunately, it itself was poorly implemented, and it provides a back door to your WPA networking. So you want to turn off WPS as well. If you have a Linksys router, you can't. This is getting more convoluted by the moment. Linksys is doing updates on some of these routers, the most modern routers. Some have already been updated with firmware to allow you to turn it off. There's a button to turn it off. You know, you go in the settings of your Linksys, you can turn it off, but it doesn't do anything. So Linksys's fix to date is to make it do something. Turn it off. If you have any other router, you should turn off WPS, turn on WPA. Now you're protected from the packets that are flying through the air. But where do they fly? They fly through the air to the wireless access spot, and then they go out to the Internet. When you're on with your bank, you're using a secure system called HTTPS. That means it's further encrypted all the way to the bank. So you're safe. In fact, you should use HTTPS whenever you can. Gmail has HTTPS. Google, in fact, now lets you turn on HTTPS for your entire Google session. Facebook has turned on HTTPS. That's very important. That means nobody can see your Facebook traffic. Remember, you're encrypting it in the Wi-Fi, but then as soon as it gets onto the Internet, if it's not secured, it's transmitting in the clear, so everybody along the way could sniff it if they wanted to. They tend not to because there's so much traffic. But if that's what you're worried about, it's probably a good idea. And that's why banks, Amazon, stores are all using HTTPS when you give them their credit card because they want to keep that protected. As long as you're doing that, I think you're all right. There's a little plugin for Mozilla called HTTPS Everywhere that turns it on as much as possible on every site possible. In my opinion, you're secure enough then. So my recommendation, Paul, is turn on WPA2 on your router and use HTTPS. You really want to use HTTPS when you're in a coffee shop or somewhere where it's an open, unencrypted access point. Then you really should do that because somebody sitting in the coffee shop can see everything you're doing otherwise. Finally, the most important thing to remember is take all these precautions, but remember that when you put things on the Internet, they somehow have a tendency to leak out to the public. Privacy on the Internet is kind of like privacy at the mall. It's hit and miss. So good luck, Paul. You're right to think about this. You're security-minded. I like that. Those are the things to do. And make sure you're using HTTPS anytime you're doing anything that you don't want somebody to see. But also remember, both sides have to support it. So if the site you're visiting isn't using it, there's nothing you can do about it. That's going to be public. Then you have to make a decision whether you use it or not. You can do something like VPN, which is gives you a little bit more security, but not a lot. GoToMeeting, or GoToMyPC rather, lets you kind of get secure from your place to your office. But as soon as it leaves that GoToMyPC or VPN environment, it's, again, unencrypted. So that's only a short-term or short-distance solution. Martin in Santa Monica, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Martin.
I like to offsite backup my file, my iPhoto library. It's 80 gigabytes. Carbonite says no more than 4 gigabytes.
Yeah, hold on a second. I'll talk about that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're talking to Martin in Santa Monica. He has an 80 gigabyte iPhoto library, and he wants to use Carbonite to back it up. Carbonite, if you go to the site and read what they say about the two articles to read are bandwidth allocation and size limit. They do, Martin, allow larger than 4 gigabyte files. They just don't select them automatically. You have to manually select it, and that is just so that people don't go, "Wow, this is taking forever," because they're backing up, you know, swap files, cache files, other giant files. So they want you to, you know, explicitly say, no, I know this is 80 gigabytes, but I want to back it up. So you can back that up in the preferences, Martin.
Okay. Any other program? I know Carbonite. I know you advertise Carbonite, but is there anything else that'll back it up more expediently, automatically?
Well, the limit is really your upload speed, right? So there's nothing, there's no magic going on. It can only go as fast as your bandwidth allows.
Okay, but is there any other program that'll back it out automatically rather than manually?
Well, you don't have to do it each time, just one time only, select it. Yeah, there are many other programs that'll do this. Many other programs out there. Crash Plan is a good one. If you have SkyDrive, well, actually, SkyDrive is limited to 25 gigs. Dropbox, if you want to pay for it. There are other choices, absolutely.
Okay, but if I use Carbonite, I have to somehow...
Just go in the preferences and say, please back up my iPhoto library. You do that once, you'll never have to do that again.
Okay, Leo, good talking to
That's
you.
To protect Thanks. You. Yeah, I mean, I would bet, I haven't looked at Crash Plan, but I bet it would have something similar as well. And that's makes sense, right? Because you don't want to be backing up monster files on your internet access. Most people don't have more than a megabit upstream. So an 80 gig, I don't have to do the math, but an 80 gigabyte is, 80,000 megabytes. And so if you're doing a megabit a second, that means it takes 10 seconds to do a megabyte. So multiply 80,000 times 10 seconds, and you'll see it's not Carbonite, it's you. Because of your bandwidth, it's going to take whatever that, I don't know what that time is. It's going to take a while. So online backup, this is probably something people should be aware of. It's not ideal in a situation where you have a lot of data. 80 gigabyte photo file, I think no problem. But I know people who are trying to back up terabytes of video online. Not a good idea. Remember, it's got to use your internet connection. There's no magic connection to Carbonite. You got to use your own personal internet connection. So it could take weeks and weeks and weeks. Months in some cases, depending on your data. Just do that simple calculation and you'll be able to figure out how long it's going to take. You know, figure out what your upstream bandwidth is. 256 kilobits, 384 kilobits. Remember, those are bits, not bytes. A megabit, those are bits, not bytes. So divide by 10 and then divide the amount of data into the amount of data you want, and you'll see it could take too long. If you're trying to back up terabytes, my suggestion is use an external drive. Take that offsite. Don't try to do it to the internet, no matter whose service you're using. Divide by 8, but I divide by 10 because there's error correction bits in there as well. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Dick DiBartolo, the gadget guru. We call him the Gizwiz. Hey, Dickie D.
Leo, how you doing?
I am well indeed.
Very good.
How's things at Gizneyland?
Things are good. Almost 60 degrees in New York City after the warmest February in history.
That's just bizarre.
It is bizarre.
It's been a weird winter.
Yeah.
Well, Dick joins us every week with a gadget. You've been to the boat show. You've been to the toy fair. You've been to CES. What do you got for us? Something exciting.
Well, you know what? Last week we talked about Solo Wheel, and it's in the works.
Am I going to get a Solo Wheel?
Yes, you expressed a desire in getting one.
You didn't want
one,
huh?
I spoke to the PR people. I'm sorry?
You decided that it wouldn't be worth risking your little neck?
No. Oh, me? No. But I figured as long as you're getting a Solo Wheel, I should look through what I have that will complement the Solo Wheel.
Oh.
So I had no crash helmets, but I thought we did talk about the Heart Sign Samaritan public access defibrillator.
That's a good idea. So, defibrillator. Yeah, that's a good idea because I have a heart attack on the Solo Wheel.
Exactly. It's only 2.4 pounds. The Solo Wheel only goes 10 miles an hour. So one of your staff can actually run next to you.
Are you breathing? No. Okay. Clear.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, even if you were breathing and I was doing it, I would want to see those tabs, you know, do their work.
So the defibrillators, you see that in, like, if you watch doctor shows on TV, that's where they go clear and they put the suction cups on your chest and they go and it starts your heart up. Like, it's like jumper cables for heart attacks.
I think that, you know what, we can sell them that as their slogan. I'm sure we can get one of these for free by giving them.
No. Yes. Now, let me ask you this. I notice when they do this, this is a big deal. They say clear that everybody has to stand back. It's dangerous. So how can they sell a consumer-grade defibrillator? Isn't it dangerous?
Okay, so now I asked that very question. I said, do you need any training at all? And the answer is no, not with the public access defibrillators.
Wow.
You slide the paddles out. There are diagrams where to place them. And then what the pads do first is do like a quick analysis. So that you know, maybe you don't need to shock
this
person.
He's sleeping. Don't bother him.
That would be very disappointing. Right. You know, it'll say this person just needs CPR, and it'll talk you through the CPR.
He just needs a good cup of coffee. He'll feel fine. You don't really want to put the paddles on him.
Come on, let me put the paddles on them. But when you do, it does say to put them on and to step away, just so you don't touch them. And then a green light will tell you that the power is going through. And unfortunately, it's not like it is in the movies. The person doesn't, you know, leap 10 feet into the air and then fall back to the ground.
What do you mean, unfortunately? That seems like a feature. I think that's good.
Well, I know, but I mean, because people like spectacle with their medical devices, I'm just telling you up front, if you're spending $1,300 to see your person jump in the air, it's probably not going to happen.
This is the kind of thing that they should have in, senior centers. They do have them at the ballpark now. They have them in a lot of public areas, schools. So that's really what this is.
You might get one for the Brick Twit House. You know, someone comes in, is so excited to see you. How many times does that happen?
People pass out all the time. Yeah. They pass out all the time.
Five times to me alone.
Right. Well, good. So this is not cheap, $1,300, but it's better than having a heart attack.
It's better than having a heart attack. Yeah. And they're at HeartSign, S-I-N-E, HeartSignSamaritan.com.
And we have to be very serious here. This is not a toy. I presume that
this is definitely not.
You can actually give somebody a heart attack by using this improperly. So don't go buy it and just as a practical joke defibrillate people.
Yes, that's fair. You know what? You should have been a doctor because this is just amazing. This is
safety first. Safety first. Dick, thank you so much. Stick around, folks. Dick DiBartolo and the weekly Daily Gizwiz coming up right after the show. Those of you in our radio audience, thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.